Hi, Caroline.
Hello.
I'm Sarah Posner, and this is The Posner Show, and today my guest is Caroline Mala Corbin. She is a professor at the University of Miami Law School and a specialist in the First Amendment, and we are going to talk about yesterday's Supreme Court decision in the Hobby Lobby case, which I guess if you've been living in a cave, I'll just say that the Supreme Court ruled that closely held corporations have religious freedom rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that were violated by the Department of Health and Human Services requirement that their insurance plans cover 20 forms of contraception. So, let's start out talking about one of the main overall conflicts over what the case means. In his majority opinion, Justice Alito takes pains to talk about how it's a very narrow decision. It's only focused on this contraception question and it doesn't apply to, say, cases of an employer wanting to use a religion-based reason for discriminating against somebody based on their race. But then in her dissenting opinion, Justice Ginsburg talks about the decision as being one of startling breadth. That is the term she used. What's your take on that?
Well, there's nothing narrow about granting corporations the right to bring religious liberty claims.
Right.
Hang on a second. You have disappeared on my screen. Anyhow, so basically now any business can claim that it should not have to abide by a law because it imposes on its religious beliefs. And mm-hmm. It's true the holding applied specifically to closely held corporations, but 90% of businesses are closely held corporations.
Right.
And these are not mom and pop stores. These are big businesses with thousands and thousands of employees.
And Hobby Lobby itself is worth billions of dollars.
Hobby Lobby itself has 13,000 full-time employees.
Right.
Never mind their part-time ones.
Right.
And furthermore, there was nothing in the opinion that precluded publicly traded corporations to also have the right to bring religious liberty claims. So, no, it's not narrow.
Well, another point that Jeffrey Toobin made at The New Yorker was that this is a common tactic used by the Roberts Court to say, this is a very narrow opinion, but then in future cases, build on that opinion to really
exactly.
expand it. So they're really just laying the groundwork for other expansions of these supposed religious freedom rights for corporations in this case, even though they're very careful to point out that this case in particular only applies to contraception coverage.
Right. I mean, and that's true of every case. The case...
Right, that's how case law works.
...only applies to the parties before it.
Right.
The reasoning of the case clearly is not so narrow.
Right. Speaking of the holding of the case and where else it applies, there's language in the majority opinion that suggests that the majority opinion says even though the government has established a compelling interest in requiring this coverage, it hasn't done so by the least restrictive means. So the majority basically said, well, look at the accommodation that the Obama administration gave to religious nonprofits. The religious
mm-hmm.
nonprofits that are not, like churches are, completely exempt from the requirement, but they have this accommodation where they can shift the responsibility for providing the coverage to their third-party administrator or their insurer instead of doing it themselves. And so they're basically saying, well, look, you know, they've already established this accommodation. Why can't they just do it for the corporations? And I was thinking to myself, well, you know, that's because these nonprofits are contesting it and you haven't decided whether that violates the nonprofit's religious freedom. So
it actually also creates a strong disincentive for the government to provide accommodations that are not constitutionally required in the future.
Right.
If every time they do, the court can then point to it as a reason why it could not also provide it outside the limited context it chose to provide it.
Right. Right, exactly. So that's a really good point, because then in the future, the government will say, well, you know, we don't want to do this because it leads
right.
to the slippery slope of more entities getting this accommodation than we originally intended to.
And it's really, if you think about it, a very odd argument to say that then you fail strict scrutiny because the government could provide the service itself instead. This would not be persuasive in a different context. For example, imagine some case where a corporation refuses to provide a service to a racial minority. Right? It seems very unlikely the court is going to say, well, but there's a least restrictive alternative to you, corporation, providing the service. The government could instead just provide the cancer screenings to Hispanics or whatever group they claim they religiously can't provide service to. It's a very unusual way of saying that strict scrutiny is not satisfied.
Well, I was also surprised that conservatives were hailing the ruling, because if that's part of what Justice Alito was saying in the case, that the government could go ahead and provide this coverage, well, their whole argument against Obamacare is that it supposedly requires the taxpayer to pay for other people's abortions, even though it doesn't. So let's just set that aside for a moment. But, you know, that's their claim. Their claim is taxpayers shouldn't have to pay for other people's abortions. So if the government provides the contraception, won't they have the argument that the taxpayer shouldn't have to pay for other people's contraception?
Well, maybe the hope is the court will say the government should do it, and then the government will never do it because the conservatives will make it impossible for the government to actually pass that kind of regulation.
Right. But what impact will this case have on that slew of cases that were brought by the religious nonprofits, by Little Sisters of the Poor, you know, the University of Notre Dame, other colleges, universities, hospitals, and so on, who are challenging they're making a different challenge than Hobby Lobby did. Their challenge is that that form that they have to fill out, that self-certification that says we're a religious organization, so we're going to push this off to our third-party administrator or our insurer, that signing that violates our religious freedom. I mean, did you read yesterday's opinion as saying we don't really buy that that's a viable claim?
Well, they didn't actually reach it. Remember, they said very specifically, we're not actually going to hold that that doesn't violate RFRA. So they reserved the question. I think the opinion sort of changed the substantial burden test to just the burden test. I mean, the idea is you're not supposed to, RFRA is not supposed to trigger strict scrutiny unless a law imposes a substantial religious burden on the plaintiff. But the court seems to only require a religious burden. There seemed to be no analysis of whether the religious burden was, in fact, substantial or not. The court seems to say, as long as the plaintiff says, as a matter of religion, I think this imposes a substantial burden on me, the court seems to say, well, as long as they're sincere, we will hold that as a matter of law, there is a substantial religious burden.
Well, I want to get to that in a minute about whether that's a correct reading of RFRA. But first, I wanted to ask you which way you think that played in terms of the future litigation of, say, the Little Sisters of the Poor.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Because they seem to read out this requirement of substantialness,
right?
They seem to say as long as the religious person sincerely believes that the law is imposing a substantial burden, they might say we find that to be a substantial burden.
But that doesn't make any sense. If they said in the opinion, well, look, the government already has a way of accommodating this. They can do it what they did for Little Sisters of the Poor, and then Little Sisters of the Poor is going to get up to the Supreme Court, and they're going to say, but that also violates religious freedom.
I understand your point, but they are the Supreme Court, and they can say that was not a holding, that was just a possibility, and upon closer scrutiny, we have decided that it imposes a substantial burden, and it fails strict scrutiny. Now, one would hope that they would find at least some burdens to really be too minimal to trigger the requirement of passing strict scrutiny.
Signing a form, for example?
For example.
But wouldn't that, if that happens, okay, let's say that happens. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, the government reads this case and the government says, HHS says, okay, Hobby Lobby, we're going to give you the same accommodation we gave Little Sisters of the Poor and Catholic hospitals and so on and so forth. And then the Little Sisters of the Poor case gets up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court strikes that down. Then where is all of this? That basically would basically say there's no way for the government to administer this program. There's no least restrictive means.
Well, they can also then reach the question that decided not to reach in this particular case about whether there was even a compelling state interest. And so they can say, we don't even need to reach the question of whether this is the least restrictive means of accomplishing the government's compelling interest, because we don't find that there are any compelling interests behind this government's goal.
Now, did they already hold that the government did establish a compelling interest?
Well, in the actual majority opinion, they assumed without deciding, although in the Kennedy concurrence, he seemed to be more insistent that, in fact, there was a compelling state interest behind it. But if you actually look at the language of the majority opinion, they did not hold that.
Interesting. Okay. So this really leaves both those questions open once the Little Sisters of the Poor or Notre Dame or one of those reaches the Supreme Court, which one of them will, right, in all likelihood?
Again, it depends whether or not they want to grant cert to it.
Right. Okay. So, but those cases are making their way through the court.
They're making their way.
If the court decided to grant cert in one of those cases, you're saying that it left itself open to find that there is no compelling state interest, and also
they could hold that this is, according to them, they claim it's a substantial burden on the religious belief, and who are we, the secular courts, to doubt this?
Right.
And therefore, we have to defer to what they say is a substantial burden or not in the religion. And furthermore, we don't find that forcing them to comply advances a compelling state interest as to them. Because also, when they were talking about the compelling interest test, they seemed to insist that the test is not, is there a compelling state interest writ large, but is there a compelling state interest in applying this law to the plaintiffs themselves?
And so these are a different kind of plaintiff than an order of nuns.
So that could be... now, of course, I think there... And forgive me, I don't remember all the details of the nuns, but I don't think the nuns were actually covered by the mandate in the first instance. So I think in that particular case, I'm not really
right.
Sure whether there was a... issue at all.
Right, because their plan is exempt under ERISA.
Yeah, right.
There's that whole...
Rise with Notre Dame.
Yeah, so, okay, right, okay. All right, so there were a lot of things that this decision yesterday did not decide and that are still open with regard to the contraception requirement. There are still things that are left undecided about the contraception requirement after yesterday's decision. You're saying that at some point in the future, the court left it open. They could still decide that there is no compelling state interest.
Although, as I said, I think there are 5 votes to argue that there is a compelling state interest.
Kennedy.
I think Kennedy's concurrence was written in order to make clear that he did think there was a compelling state interest.
Okay. Yeah, I see. All right. So let's get in the weeds on RFRA and what Justice Ginsburg talked about in her dissenting opinion about the majority's misreading, trying to remember the precise words to use, misguided, misreading, and so on and so forth, of RFRA. Now, did that mostly have to do with the giving the religious right the religious rights to the corporate form, or did that also have to do with the substantial burden analysis that the majority employed?
I think she would say that both of those conclusions were wrong, but I think her critique of the RFRA was focused more on expanding it to include for-profit corporations as well. Because RFRA was actually meant to track free exercise jurisprudence.
Right.
And the court claimed it was meant to make a clean break with it. And that is what she criticized. She said, no, RFRA was not supposed to make a break with free exercise. It was supposed to track it. And there was nothing in free exercise jurisprudence that would suggest that for-profit corporations were entitled to religious liberty claims. And if you think about it, it doesn't make much sense. I mean, the Free Exercise Clause has always historically protected either individuals or sort of voluntary organizations of religious individuals, i.e. churches.
Right.
So historically, the Free Exercise Clause, religious liberty, has applied to individuals and to churches. And corporations are very different from individuals and very different from for-profit corporations.
Right. So I was sort of amazed by the majority opinions. I hesitate to call it an analysis of this point. I mean, their discussion of RFRA and why it was okay to extend RFRA's protections to corporations, to for-profit corporations, was, if I can summarize it, was, well, Congress didn't say anything about not doing that, so why not?
and there was sort of a little new math in there, sort of like, well, if individuals who are motivated or for-profit individuals can bring claims, and if non-profit corporations can bring claims, then ta-da, you know, for-profit corporations can bring claims, overlooking the fact that you're talking about people in churches. And the reasons we protect people in churches don't apply to for-profit corporations.
Well, Ginsburg talks about that in her dissent. She talks about obviously individuals is obvious, but with regard to churches, she said that we've always given them a special solicitude and we've never extended that to for-profit corporations because a church exists to serve people who come together because they share the same faith and share the same ideas, and they voluntarily come to church because they share all of those same ideas and that same religion. You don't go to work because you share your boss's religious beliefs.
Right. I mean, she says the phrase she uses is a community of believers. Mm-hmm. She said everyone who belongs to a church have joined the church because they share common beliefs. Right? That's not how you would describe corporations. These are not people who voluntarily join the corporation in order to further the religious beliefs of the corporation. And second, in churches, she didn't mention this, but it's sort of apparent, the overriding sort of activity of a church is the practice of religion. The overriding activity of a corporation is not practice of religion.
Right.
And so to say that churches and for-profit corporations are legally the same sort of overlooks these major distinctions and sort of brings into question why we treat churches distinctively in the first place.
Well, that's a question. That's water under the bridge at this point, right? Or not.
No, the argument is churches are special and therefore they get special treatment. Mm-hmm. And now you're arguing, actually, no, churches are just like corporations. Corporations are just like churches. You sort of undermine the rationale for that special treatment.
Right. That's true. That's true. That's a good point. So what do you think is next in terms of the accommodation? I mean, do you think that, I mean, does the Supreme Court's decision yesterday compel the Department of Health and Human Services to do something? I mean, because if say HHS did nothing and Congress did nothing, mm-hmm. then couldn't Hobby Lobby go back to court and say, look, they've done nothing to fix this least restrictive means problem, and so they're in violation of RFRA?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the whole thing now is that Hobby Lobby does not have to offer contraception in its plan.
So they can go ahead and not do that. And the question is, will the government require them to shift that burden of providing the coverage to their insurer?
Now the call is in the government's court about how they're going to handle this particular review. What is their response to this statutorily required religious exemption for Hobby Lobby and Conestoga?
Okay. And presumably the other 40-something corporations that have sued also. So as it stands now, Hobby Lobby can call up its insurance carrier today and say, drop the LFNB and IUDs from our plan, right? And then if the government, they could do that today.
I don't know how quickly orders go into effect, but essentially that's the bottom line.
Okay.
They are not required to offer these four types of contraception in their health insurance plans.
Okay, and so then the ball is in HHS's court to draft a new regulation that enables Hobby Lobby and all the similarly situated corporations to sign that self-certification.
It's up to the government to figure out how the women working for those companies can now access contraception.
Okay, and that will be sort of complicated because there are some of these companies that are owned by Catholic owners who don't want to provide any contraception at all. And then there are the companies like Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood that say they object to only these four methods of contraception, but not the 16 others. Do you think that will be a complicated thing for HHS to regulate and resolve?
I don't know about how complicated it was in the nonprofit context, so I'm not really sure what is administratively required in order to get an alternate proposal off the ground.
Mm-hmm. But the government has to do something now. Unless they don't have to. They can just say, okay, all these women who work for these companies just won't have this coverage.
Right. The whole thing is that these corporations do not have to comply with the contraception mandate if they allege it violates their sincerely held religious beliefs.
But couldn't this lead to this scenario?
So let me just be clear. Okay. This means that the court has said it is okay to shift a burden onto third parties when you grant religious exemptions.
Okay.
They're saying we are not holding that religious exemptions cannot shift burdens onto third parties. Although, if you actually look at the way they talk about it, right, they characterize contraception as a benefit from the corporation rather than a right of the women working there to avoid making what I just say more apparent. Right? So they don't just come out and say, it's okay to shift burdens onto third parties, because they try and argue that this is not a burden on third parties because they were not entitled to this in the first place.
Okay.
Which is a kind of sneaky way of shifting baselines. That's not really a fair way to describe what the baseline is now.
Because legally speaking, these employees did have the right to this, but the court is not recognizing that as such.
No, it's not a right. It's a benefit that the corporation is bestowing on its workers.
Well, that used to be what it was before the Affordable Care Act, right?
Exactly. And the court is not acknowledging that the Affordable Care Act changed the baseline in terms of what workers are entitled to.
Yeah. Wow, there are many ways in which the opinion really undermines this in ways that I hadn't really thought about fully until you started pointing out all these different things. Okay, interesting. So where else could this lead in terms of claims by corporate? Well, let me back up for a minute.
Sure.
I have a question specifically about the contraception. So now that this ruling is out there, what would stop a corporation from saying, say they looked at their bottom line and say they thought, maybe we could cut some costs by cutting certain benefits out of our insurance plan. Let's try to cut this and say that they violate their religious beliefs.
Right.
Is there anything stopping them from doing that before, even if they haven't raised those claims in the past?
The court did make clear that it still had the power to evaluate whether the claims were sincere.
Okay.
So if the court thought that this was just a pretext and not based on a sincere religious objection, then they can say, no exemption. It's only sincere religious objections that are accommodated.
So, but how would that play out, legally speaking? So, say Corporation X decides to cut the contraception coverage from their plan. Well, who is going to contest that? Will the employees contest it, or would the government contest it? How would that question even reach the courts?
It would reach the court the same way this case did. The employer will say, we're cutting it because it violates our rights under RFRA, and then the court would adjudicate whether they have a valid RFRA claim or not.
But who would bring the lawsuit? Because it seems like the corporation wouldn't necessarily bring a lawsuit. They would just drop the coverage, but they would get in trouble, they would have to pay the tax if they didn't.
Yes. Right. Oh, I see. Someone would challenge their right to not cover it, and they would respond by saying, no, we have an exemption under RFRA.
Right. So,
although I think contraception might be the one example that companies would not cut in order to save costs, because generally speaking, providing contraception saves money rather than costs.
Right. But I was just wondering if there was a way.
But you could imagine it with a whole number of other services. They could decide, well, we don't want to cover this kind of treatment anymore because we are religiously opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then questions would arise as well. Is that in fact based on a sincere religious belief?
Right. And Alito did say in the majority opinion that something like immunizations would present a different kind of question.
Yes, although he didn't say the answer would necessarily be different. He just said the arguments would be different.
Right, okay.
Right? Because he might still, at the end of the day, say there is a compelling state interest in ensuring that people are vaccinated, but there is a less restrictive alternative. The government can provide vaccinations instead of the corporations. So there's no guarantee that the ultimate outcome would be different. Now, having said that, I think the court's evaluation might be different because vaccinations is not tainted in the court's mind, in the way that contraception is. I think there is definitely an abortion taint, right? And I think this may just be another case in a long line of cases where the application of rules or the rules themselves are different in cases that involve abortion, even though this case does not, in fact, involve abortion.
I was about to say that. the justices thought that it involved abortion because the plaintiffs had made such a vociferous case about it actually involving abortion. And the court basically said, well, we see that the government and some of the amici parties contested the claim that Ella, Plan B, and IUDs can be abortifacients, but we don't really care because the bottom line is that these people sincerely believe that it might cause an abortion, and that's the only inquiry that matters. So you can sincerely believe that the world is flat. And
exactly.
Then what?
So one would hope that part of the substantial burden inquiry would be to make sure that the plaintiffs, not the religious beliefs, but have accurate facts, but apparently that was not brought up in this case.
Right. And so do you find that problematic in terms
of
future cases?
Obviously, right? Yeah. I mean, as I said before, you're entitled to your own religious beliefs, but you're not entitled to your own set of facts.
Yes.
Right? It's actually a quote stolen from somebody else. But
right.
Like this case,
yes.
If you're going to argue, I am morally opposed to abortion, and therefore I don't want to cover this drug, and the drug, in fact, has nothing to do with abortion, then it doesn't, in fact, clash with your religious beliefs at all to provide it.
Right.
Or another example, if you're religiously opposed to working in a factory that makes armaments, and you're actually working in a factory that makes toys, right, that should matter.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about broadly what the consequences are of this, the legal consequences are of yesterday's decision in terms of the expansion of this right to corporations, but also this idea that, you know, you're entitled to your sincerely held religious beliefs, even if they conflict with the medical evidence or scientific evidence or what have you, or reality. So what do you see? How will this play out in the future? What other sorts of claims might be possible because of this decision?
Well, I would hope that the reason the court didn't address it was because the government didn't object. And that if there were...
You're talking about the, whether the drugs and devices are abortion.
Right, whether the drugs in fact did what they thought they did. Mm-hmm. Not whether that what they thought they did opposed their religious beliefs, mm-hmm. right? If they believe that it killed an embryo,
right.
they're entitled to believe that's a sin. The question is, do these drugs in fact kill any embryos? No.
Mm-hmm.
Plan B has been conclusively proven to prevent ovulation, so there are no embryos in the plant when people take Plan B. There's no embryos are created, so
right.
none are killed. Embryos are just not in the picture. So really, there's nothing about Plan B that conflicts with their religious beliefs. And the court just didn't address the question. And as I said, at least it didn't say, well, at least it didn't address it and say it doesn't matter what the facts are. We're just going to accept what they claim the facts are. They didn't go that far. So I'm hoping when there is a case where this clash is presented more clearly, the court will say, well, part of the substantial burden test means you have to get your facts. You at least have to be based in
right.
reality.
Do you think it was a mistake for the government to not contest that claim, to not contest the claim that those drugs and devices cause abortion?
I think so. But I think part of the problem is that a couple of them work differently than the morning after pills work differently than the IUDs.
Mm-hmm.
And the IUDs might prevent implantation of a fertilized egg in the uterus. And they might have just wanted to deal with the issue rather than sort of have that as an additional issue to consider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, maybe they thought that they just couldn't. Yeah, I mean, obviously they had to have thought about it, but maybe they concluded that it didn't help their case.
Wouldn't ultimately avoid the case because there were still a couple of methods of contraception that involved implantation as opposed to ovulation, and so the question was going to have to be reached regardless.
But even with like the copper IUD, yeah. it's a very remote chance that there might be a prevention of implantation. Really,
yeah.
it's, you know, the vast, vast majority of the time it prevents fertilization.
So it's a shame
yeah.
that was not that the actual facts. And maybe, I do not know why that was not contested more strongly, because I think it makes a huge difference.
Yes, yes. So let's just talk about future cases with just the piece of it, the expansion of the corporate religious rights. I mean, does this just open a flood, or do you think that we'll just see, you know, occasional, how much do you think this is going to impact consumers, employees, people whose lives are affected by what corporations decide to do?
Right, well, I mean, this ruling itself already has a huge impact on
mm-hmm.
people. I keep hearing the phrase, oh, you're just hypothesizing a whole parade of horribles and it's never going to come to pass. And I'm like, the parade has started, right? That's a giant float we just saw going by, right?
Right?
Women have lost access to contraception in companies where the owners are religiously opposed to it. And that's hugely problematic in itself.
Right, right.
I mean, it's not just owners' religious rights that are at issue here. It's also the workers' religious rights. I
yes.
mean, there may be, you know, sure, some religions say you shouldn't use contraception, but there are certainly religious obligations that could point towards contraception
absolutely.
Use.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so now we have a situation where one group's religious rights are privileged over another group's, and surprise, surprise, it's those who are already in power who have rights to religious liberty, and those who are the have-nots that don't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think it's an incredible expansion of the sort of distinction between haves and have-nots, and I think it really exacerbates that problem. And it exacerbates it with something that really should not be sort of distributed based on money, and that's religious liberty.
Right.
And so religious liberty has become yet another something special reserved for the elite.
Right, right. So here's another religious liberty issue, which has obviously been on people's minds and been on the news. This whole question of, can the baker or the photographer refuse to serve the same-sex couple? I mean, does this decision
yes.
yesterday have any impact on those sorts
of
claims?
Because assuming the federal government passes laws that ban discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, because we don't have those laws yet.
Right. Some states do, but right.
Some states do. Note, though, that RFRA applies only to the federal government.
Right, that's right.
And not to the states. So that's something.
Mm-hmm.
But assuming the federal government does eventually pass protection against discrimination based on sexual orientation, you could very much expect to have corporations object to these laws based on their religious beliefs. So those may be the next set of cases that come down. But of course, the predicate for those cases is that we, in fact, outlaw discrimination based on sexual orientation.
Right, right. Which is that's a question that could happen in Congress as currently comprised, which is a whole other question.
So yes, those cases will definitely arise. And then the question is, would the outcome be the same?
Mm-hmm.
And there's hope that perhaps they wouldn't, given that, at least at the Supreme Court level, given that Justice Kennedy seems much more sympathetic towards sexual orientation discrimination than he is towards sex discrimination.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But that I think will be another group of cases eventually.
Is there another context that you can think of outside LGBT rights and healthcare where this could be applicable?
Again, theoretically, anytime a corporation thinks a legal requirement infringes on their religious beliefs, they can make a claim.
So an employer could say, we don't like this OSHA requirement because we don't believe in letting people sit down while they're working during the day or something. You know, I mean, that's ridiculous. But
exactly. I don't know what those claims are, but they are theoretically possible.
But there would have to be the substantial burden showing in order to prevail.
Well, as I said, in theory, it's supposed to be a substantial burden on the religious practice, although at this point it seems only that they have to allege sincerely that it's a substantial burden on the religious practice. Because, again, what we have here was not a case where they were forced to do something. Like, they were not forced to take contraception.
Mm-hmm.
Their claim was that they were forced to facilitate other people's consumption mm-hmm. of contraception. And there's really no principled stopping point for a facilitation argument. Right?
I mean, yeah.
Well, we also think it facilitates abortion to hire people who had abortions or to hire people who've been married to people who had. I mean, people can have all kinds of sincere religious beliefs, and all of them apparently would be considered substantial, and all of them would subject whatever law that's being challenged to strict scrutiny and a real strict scrutiny. And in free exercise jurisprudence, the balancing was not weighed so much in favor of the claimant as the court seems to be interpreting RFRA.
Right.
Which again, brings us back to this point that RFRA was not supposed to be a break with previous religious liberty jurisprudence. It was supposed to be a return to the jurisprudence
before the Peyote case.
Exactly.
Right, right. So, don't you think it's odd that Justice Scalia was the author of that case, the majority opinion in Employment Division v. Smith?
Well, one thing that the cases seem to have in common is this incredible reluctance for the government to get involved in evaluating sort of the centrality of a religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons behind switching from the test you have in RFRA to the test they imposed in Employment Division versus Smith, where they said, listen, if this is just a neutral law that applies to everybody, it doesn't violate the free exercise claim. One of the reasons they wanted to move toward the test that looks more at the law and less at the burden on religious believers is that they didn't want the government getting involved in evaluating whether a burden was substantial or not, right? So in that case, they went on the side of saying, well, nothing's a burden. Where in this case, they still have that same concern, but now they're saying, because we're worried about evaluating the centrality of people's belief and evaluating whether a burden is really substantial or not, we're just going to say everything's a substantial burden.
Right. Well, there was a lot of deference given to what the religious beliefs were.
Yes.
Yeah, right. But in Smith, there was really none. I mean, and that was a minority religion versus in Hobby Lobby, it's a majority religion, Christianity. So,
right.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for doing this today.
Sure.
and hopefully we'll do it again sometime, but hopefully not about a case like this.
Okay.
Thanks, Carolyn.
All right.